So hello everyone, I'm thrilled to see how packed the room is. Do come up, there are still a few more seats up here. So the title of my talk is the Farm Bill and Food and Health Bill and Environmental Public Health, an overview. And I have no relationships to disclose, except I'm proud to disclose that I work for the Center for a Livable Future, which is an academic center at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and we focus on connections between diet, food production, environment, and public health. And my role, as she was just saying, is to provide the introduction and framing about the Farm Bill. And because this section, for two reasons, I'm going to specifically focus on environmental public health impacts. And one is, this is actually organized through the environment section. And the other reason is that part of this, the genesis of this presentation comes from a collaboration between some public health groups and sustainable agriculture, working towards identifying joint priorities for the upcoming Farm Bill. So starting with the very basic background, the Farm Bill is a broad omnibus bill. Omnibus means it includes everything, including the kitchen sink. It's reauthorized every 5 to 6 years, and it's essentially the key legislation on farm, food, land use, and rural policy. And a lot of us would also say it's one of the top policies affecting public health. So when a lot of people in public health think about the Farm Bill, this is their first thought. And perhaps people in environmental public health may think of it this way. Or alternately, people think about it this way. It's the corporate Farm Bill, calories, 180 bazillion, total fat. It is not a significant source of vegetables, fruit, vitamins, et cetera. Oh, you get the idea. And shame, 0%. And I would say that there is some truth to all of these, but there's also truth to this, that the Farm Bill has a lot of pieces in it that can promote healthy food production as well as sustainable food production and access. So here's an overview of the most recent Farm Bill, and I'll just give you a second to read all the titles. I'm not going to read them out loud to you. But you can see that there's a lot of these just by the names of them. You may get the sense that there's public health in these. And many of us have discussed for the next Farm Bill, you know, could there be a public health title where we could get Congress to articulate the public health impacts of the Farm Bill as well as potentially putting some of the public health pieces into it, and it could be an organizing call to action as well for the public health community. Or going along that health in all policies framework, could there be public health in all titles? So here's the 2008 Farm Bill spending. Does anybody know what the gray circle is that's two-thirds of the Farm Bill? So the number one answer that I'm hearing is commodities. Actually, it's the nutrition title. The biggest piece of the Farm Bill is actually SNAP, or food stamps. And commodities is second there. Conservation is actually third. And there's many intersections between Farm Bill and public health, and I consider just canceling the rest of the presentation and having you read this. It's actually a very interesting graphic if you do get a chance to look through it. You could also just focus on the environmental side on the right, on the left-hand side, right-hand side. Very good. But really, a simpler way of thinking about why the Farm Bill is a public health bill: it affects what we eat, it affects environmental health and sustainability, food insecurity, equity, and there's some other cross-cutting pieces, particularly research, for example, cuts through all of these. And because, as I said, the mission is to focus on environmental health, I'm going to discuss these four aspects of environmental health and sustainability. First is that the Farm Bill provides a lot of support for agriculture with negative environmental impacts. That's the mainstream food production that is supported through the Farm Bill. Second, it has support for sustainable agriculture and conservation. Third, there are pieces in there that can support local and regional food systems. And finally, food environments, with which the public health community is increasingly coming to recognize that the built environment is also a key, and the food environment is a key part of environmental health as well. So starting with agriculture with negative environmental health impacts, I thought it would be useful just to briefly frame this out by talking about what are some of the environmental impacts of our mainstream industrial food production. And it's just a brief listing here, and this isn't, of course, everything, but resource depletion, contamination, loss of biodiversity, antimicrobial resistance. That's because of the antimicrobials that are fed to food animals. Greenhouse gas emissions, the top sources being livestock production and soil, the treatment of soil and land use. Generally a non-resilient system, and resilience is a word that's gaining a lot of currency these days, and the basic concept is that it's not resilient to a lot of the shocks that could come our way, whether climate change, drought, dramatic rises in price of oil, and so on. And finally, overproduction. We produce a lot more than we need, and we eat a lot more than we need, and we also waste a quarter to a third of our food supply that's produced. So every bit of overproduction that happens, a way to think about it is that it's all of those impacts that didn't need to happen. And there are a lot of incentives within farm policy that promote that overproduction. So I'll start out with commodity policy. And it's important to note that it goes beyond subsidies. And the first place we always look is subsidies, but there's programs to support marketing of food. There's programs that support basically getting the commodities that are produced through the Farm Bill into schools and low-income communities. There's a lot of other pieces that are promoting commodity production. So the commodity policy in this country, for the most part, is supporting five main crops: corn, soybeans, rice, wheat, and cotton. And these, because of where the support is going, that influences the dominance of these products in our food system. And I think it's important for public health to understand the issue of farmers are very threatened, I think, when a lot of public health people and others talk about these issues. And I think it's important to understand that these commodity policies, in some sense, are a safety net that's necessary. And just as when we talk about food insecurity, we think that it's important both to question the fundamental underlying social and economic conditions that lead so many people to be food insecure, we also think it's important to provide a safety net in the meantime. And so, you know, there's an argument to be made on that behalf as well. Credit and crop insurance is something that is going to, I believe, receive much more attention, public attention in the future. Basically, because of the foods that have been so dominant in the food system, there's a lot more historical data on the yields and things like that of these crops. And that provides data for actuarial use that enables loans to occur, it enables insurance and things like that. And those same kinds of loans and insurance are much less available for those producing sustainably fruits and vegetables, small and more diverse farms. And so how can we get the data out there to enable those kinds of farms to have that same kind of data supporting them? I'm going to skip that. Another key piece of what's going on with the commodity production, it's important to understand that even though there's actually relatively few pieces in the Farm Bill that specifically focus on food animal production, but a very significant chunk of the Farm Bill is actually going as an indirect subsidy to industrial food animal production by supporting the feeds. I think it's 60% of corn and 40% of soy that we produce in this country, and it may even be higher, are going as feeds for food animals. So those are some of the negative impacts that are supported through our farm policy. Let's talk about some of the positive ones. Sustainable agriculture and conservation. And I'm just going to frame this one out by talking a little bit more about what we mean by having a resilient food system. It includes things like soil health, biodiversity, soil that can retain water, and effective use of water, because water shortages over the upcoming years are going to be very significant in our ability to assure a stable and affordable food supply. Non-contaminated soils and water, and diversified food production, diversified both within farms and diversified within areas, are really important for sustainability. And of course, underlying all this, it needs to be economically sustainable, and there needs to be a diversity of size of food production facilities. So brief summary of the key conservation programs, and I'm sure Ferd will be going into more detail on some of this. But I'll talk about, there's two main ones that focus on providing incentives to farms to implement conservation and sustainable practices within their production. EQIP is notable for two reasons. One, because it's got this new emphasis on organic conversion in the most recent farm bill that's provides a very positive opportunity. It also has a 60% set-aside for livestock producers, and that basically, in many cases, has enabled them, for example, to build a new manure lagoon so that they can get larger while still complying with environmental regulations. So there's a lot of questions about, is this actually environmentally beneficial? But generally speaking, there are a lot of positive environmental impacts of these two programs. And then there's the reserve programs that take land out of production for a period of time, and that enables the land and the wild stock and the wildlife to basically recover for a period of time. And here's the main one. The biggest one is Conservation Reserve Program. The Wetlands Reserve Program, I understand, is potentially challenged in the upcoming Farm Bill, particularly challenged, I should say. The Farm Bill has a number of incentives for sustainable food production. In the most recent Farm Bill, there was a dramatic increase in funding for organic agriculture, and I think I'm sure you guys had a very major role to play in that. There's also sustainable agriculture production funds for research, extension, or providing technical assistance to farmers, and funds for socially disadvantaged and new farmers. And we need the supply of new farmers coming in, and in order to, because a lot of the farmers are aging. What's the average age of a farmer, like 60 plus or something? So we really need to keep that pipeline coming. Local and regional food systems. There's a number of provisions within the Farm Bill that address this. And I think it's important to preface that by saying that it's not necessarily, there's no necessary connection between where food is produced and how sustainable it is or how healthy it is. But often when we're talking about local and regional food and the food that's distributed through those channels, it often is produced in a more sustainable way and a more healthy way. And it is it may be more like fresh produce. So there's pieces in the last Farm Bill, and APHA was very active on a couple of these last time around. Community food projects and healthy urban foods and food enterprise development basically are all kinds of innovative projects at the local level to improve food access and access to healthy and more sustainably produced foods, whether through the nonprofit sector or at the enterprise level. There's a number of provisions in the Farm Bill related to farmers markets and improving access to farmers markets and making the produce more affordable and marketing farmers markets so that people know about them. And finally, there's a number of pieces relevant to research, and I'll come back to research. I want to talk about the food environment. So here's some of the contributors to the obesity epidemic. This says childhood obesity, don't take it lightly. My kind of shopping spree, it's the dollar menu. And I would start with, when we think about the food environment, ubiquity, variety. Ubiquity, you can go into your car repair shop and find a large display of processed food that you can buy. I mean, it's everywhere, and snacks are everywhere, and we're sort of expected to eat nonstop 24/7. And variety, there's so much variety of food products, and there's a lot of evidence from behavioral economics suggesting that the more food is available and the more that it's offered to us and the more choices we have, the more likely we are to have some of it. The food supply composition affects our food environments in important ways because what we have in our food supply, which is basically the foods that our farm policy is pushing towards, are the ones that are going to be most available in the mainstream food supply. And that's what you're going to see in the so-called food deserts. That's what you're going to see in places that have relatively low access is only that dominant food supply. And finally, of course, incentives, including price, have an important impact on what people choose to eat. And here, many of you have seen this slide. But basically, fresh fruits and vegetables, this comes from IATP's report, fresh fruits and vegetables, prices have gone up dramatically in the past years, and soft drinks and relatively less healthy foods prices have come down. So in order to reduce the prices of relatively healthy foods, we need to be thinking about incentives to increase healthy food production, because the more supply there is and the more sort of knowledge about how to do it more affordably, the lower the prices can be. And there was a wonderful report that came out from a group called FLAG that really walks in great, tremendous detail through a number of different interventions that can be done to increase healthy food supply. And I would encourage that people taking a look at that. And here's some examples. Mom, can I have another apple? Do you think they grow on trees? And then there's geographic access to healthy food. And this is a map of Baltimore and its northwest suburbs showing how the healthier food is dramatically more available in communities that are more African American versus white. And there are a number of provisions that either are in the Farm Bill or could be inserted into the Farm Bill. The Healthy Food Financing Initiative comes out of Philadelphia or Pennsylvania and basically provides financing incentives for primarily supermarket location, but it could be other healthy food store locations in areas that are underserved. And there's a lot of talk about potentially getting that into the Farm Bill. There was some policy in the last Farm Bill to do a food desert study. There's the farmers markets, things that I talked about earlier. So there are a number of potential ways that we can seed the Farm Bill to help improve geographic access. And finally, I really think it's important to talk about research. I think that's a major opportunity for the public health community in terms of areas that we focus on. There are a number of pieces within the research title, within the research programs at USDA that specifically mention public health-oriented research. So that's great. We're in the middle of analysis, and I think we're going to find that the actual dollars are not all that high. But that's a place where potentially there could be more opportunity. And there's a lot of evidence that where there's more research, where there's more R&D on food, prices can come down. And so that would include healthy and more sustainable food production. We need a lot more research in the production methods. I'm skipping that. So in summary, the Farm Bill is a public health bill. The Farm Bill is an environmental public health bill. There's a lot that we can do, and there's a lot of places that we can fit into this. We're hearing a lot, and we're going to keep hearing through this presentation, that there's not a lot of opportunity in this Farm Bill to ask for things that cost much money, if any money at all. We may be spending a lot of our energy holding on to what we've got. However, knowing what's out there and being aware of the ideas and opportunities can give us the best insights into how to target the public health community's work to address the priority problems within the Farm Bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ronnie. We'll have Ferd come up now.
Great, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and that was a super job. It made my job so much easier. Nothing to look at on my presentation, so you'll just have to, for those visual learners out there, I apologize in advance. I'm going to basically try to do two things. I was asked to give a little bit of the political and fiscal context of the Farm Bill, especially since something called the election just happened. So I will try to do that. And then, as was said earlier, I will try to address the intersection of sustainable agriculture and public health. But what I will actually do is just throw a lot of spaghetti against the wall and see if anything sticks in your minds as we get into discussion later. Because frankly, I don't know the answers, and I'd like to find out. So just let me start with just a brief word about the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. We're an alliance of grassroots-based organizations from all around the country, over 85 members. There are farmer groups, there are a few food groups, conservation organizations and rural development organizations make up the core of our membership. We've been at this, the Farm Bill part of our work through the last four Farm Bills, and just to give you a sense of some of the things we've done to put our work in context, in the conservation environment area, if you've heard of programs, some of which Ronnie mentioned, like the Wetlands Reserve Program or the Conservation Stewardship Program, Environmental Quality Incentives Program, those all now are big deal federal programs, but at one point were just little germs in the minds of people that were in our group. In research and education, the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, the Organic Research and Extension Initiative, the Beginning Farmer Development Program, and several others were all, you know, built out of the NSAC organization. In the marketing and food systems arena, the Farmers Market Promotion Program, small but important program, National Organic Certification Cost Share Program, the Organic Conversion Program, which is now in the conservation arena but didn't start out there, and several others, value-added producer grants. We've also done a lot of work over the years on beginning farmer programs, many of which are going strong right now. In the commodity area, we've been far less successful, but we have succeeded in two major respects. This is sort of ancient history now, but all the way back in the 1990 Farm Bill sort of leveled the playing field for sustainable diversified producers in the commodity program arena, and then in the next Farm Bill after that actually went to the planting flexibility model that's current policy with respect to all commodities except fruit and vegetables, which we'll get into in just a minute. But those were major campaigns that, you know, have borne substantial, I would say, fruit, except it's the wrong word. So that's just to give you some idea of some of the things that we've done in Farm Bill campaigns in the past. I think it's fair to say we know how to get a few things done in what is otherwise usually a very difficult political environment and very difficult congressional committees to deal with. So just a tad on the fiscal situation going into this Farm Bill. You already saw the pie charts on the total spending. I think it's also important to look at where the trend lines are. And in the last two Farm Bills, unlike the one that's coming up, there was more money put into the Farm Bill till. And so it's interesting to look at where that money wound up. In 2002, there was a lot more money in the till, almost $75 billion. And while the majority of that went to commodity programs, conservation and nutrition, particularly food stamps, came out fairly well. In 2008, a lot less money, but still, you know, still in the billions, so still important, $14.5 billion. The majority of that went to food stamps, and about a quarter went to conservation, and none of it went to commodities except for fruit and vegetables. So I think that's important to see where the trend lines are moving. So here's the nutshell on the Farm Bill. It's a two locomotive bill. There's two locomotives, the commodity programs and food stamps. Without those two locomotives, there wouldn't be a Farm Bill. Without either one of those two locomotives, there wouldn't be a Farm Bill. And you know, we could write the food system bill to beat all food systems bill. If there was no commodities, no food stamps, you wouldn't have a bill. That's about as simply as I could put it in terms of the political context. However, the flip side of that is there are a lot of trains on that are connected to those locomotives, and there's a lot of really important public policy that can be done on those trains. So I will walk through the same titles that Ronnie showed you, but just sort of throw out some ideas on each one as we go. But first, a few more context points. There is a substantial building of financial resources in the conservation and environment area. If we go back, I've been working on Farm Bills in D.C. since 1977. 77 and 81, the first two I did, there was a big goose egg. There was nothing for conservation. And then now we've seen it gradually increase to the point where not in this Farm Bill cycle, where we've almost reached $5 billion a year in conservation money, but in the out years, which will be the next Farm Bill cycle, we're up to $6 billion. In fact, we're now tied with the commodity title looking forward the next 10 years in total amount of money, which is quite an achievement, going from zero to tied with the commodity title. So there's a lot of progress there, a lot less progress every place else. If you add up all the other things, rural development, forestry, energy, specialty crops, organic, beginning farmers, minority farmers, and all the other miscellaneous things. You add that all up together, three Farm Bills ago there was zero, and the last two Farm Bills there's been $2 billion for all of those things combined. Not an inconsequential sum, but relatively small potatoes compared to the rest. So that's all, that's sort of the end of the good news part of the context. Here comes the bad news. The next Farm Bill is going to be a sub-baseline bill. You're going to take the amount of spending that's available in the baseline today for the next Farm Bill, and they'll be writing a bill that's going to be somewhat less than that. Could be a lot less, could be somewhat less, but it's definitely not going to be more. That's a problem in and of itself, but the problem is worse than that, because many of the programs that are near and dear to my heart, whether it's farmers market promotion or organic research or beginning of minority farmer programs, a few of the conservation programs, including the Wetlands Reserve and the Grassland Reserve, I could go on, but suffice it to say there are 38 Farm Bill programs with no baseline, so they start out in this coming Farm Bill cycle having to get back what we have now in today's law. That equals a $9 billion hole. It's not quite as bad as it seems from the Sustainable Ag perspective. About half of that is disaster payment money. But still, a $4.5 billion hole is nothing to sneeze at. It's going to take a lot of hard, heavy lifting just to get back to status quo. In fact, getting back to status quo will probably not quite be possible, but I think we can get a long ways there. And if that wasn't gloomy enough, there's very high likelihood that there's going to be budget reconciliation legislation before we get to the Farm Bill. That's a whole other topic, but basically, in the Farm Bill terms, think of budget reconciliation legislation as refighting the last Farm Bill fight and reducing expenditures. That will very possibly happen prior to the next Farm Bill. And so that will be, in essence, a mini Farm Bill before we get to the real deal. So just a brief word about the agriculture committees. Why do people serve on the agriculture committees? Because of their commodity farmers. That has been the true of almost everybody that's ever served. And that is the political reality. We can complain about it, but that is the political reality. However, let me give you this little bright point. On the House side, there are going to be 10 or maybe a dozen new Republican seats open for people coming in. Most of those members, quite likely, will be replacing the same Democrats who just got beat from farm districts. There won't be a lot of change in perspective or ideology there. However, on the Democratic side, there will be 4 or 5 seats available. And because Blue Dog Democrats from farm districts, many of them have gotten defeated, there's not a ready pool of people to jump at those 5 seats. So there's an enormous opportunity here to get non-traditional members serving on the Agriculture Committee. I can't emphasize that point enough. I started my Farm Bill career working for a member of the Agriculture Committee from New York City in 1977. And there, since he and a congresswoman from Boston who served at the same time on the Republican side left in 1980, I believe it was, that was the last time there was an urban member on the committee. And believe me, there was a lot of interesting dynamics that took place while they served. And it could happen again if we do our homework. So that's a little bit on that. The political dynamic, the strongest political dynamic about the Farm Bill, you'll hear this repeated by almost everybody that talks about the Farm Bill, is it tends to be regional politics, not party politics. So it really does break down more by region and commodity than necessarily by party. Therefore, when a house changes hands, it has less impact on Farm Bill than many, many other subjects. And then last but not least, on the context setting side, as Ronnie indicated, the vast majority of Farm Bill funds are in the nutrition title, and the vast majority of those are in food stamps. The food stamp political dynamic vis-a-vis the Farm Bill is fairly consistent. The nutrition, anti-hunger part of the nutrition community regularly sides with the status quo on issues related to Farm Bill reform in order, in their view, to maximize the total dollars going to the nutrition title. That has been true almost without exception in my career, and every reason to expect it to happen again, but I just raise that and put that out there because there is a fundamental train wreck between trying to reform the Farm Bill and trying to deal with that political reality. So I just toss that out there. People have been asking me in the hall about the chairmanships of the committees. Frank Lucas will be the incoming chair of the House Agriculture Committee from Oklahoma. And the chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee is still a little bit up for grabs. There's a reasonably strong likelihood that it could wind up being Senator Stabenow from Michigan, who has a very different set of traditional interests than might usually be the case for committee leaders, her interest being in specialty crops and nutrition and research and energy and climate change. That could be very interesting. There's still a possibility that Kent Conrad from North Dakota has more seniority, will claim the chair. He'll have to give up budget to do that, and budget committee is near and dear to his heart. So we'll see. We'll probably know next week how that comes out. So enough of all that. Let me quickly get into the titles. And my idea here is to just throw out one or two ideas for each title and see if it causes any interest. So let me start with the commodity title. It is the first title of the bill, usually. So I guess it's a good place to start. I will just say, and both of these subjects are huge topics in and of themselves, so I'll just toss this out there. I do think that what often gets said or read in the effects of commodity policy on lowering commodity prices and therefore encouraging things like obesity, while there's a grain of truth in it, it tends to be overblown in the popular media. It's a fairly marginal effect. Remember, there's complete planting flexibility today, so farmers don't have to grow corn or don't have to grow soybeans. They can grow anything they want except fruits and vegetables. And they can raise livestock. They don't have to farm at all. They still get their payments. So they're, you know, given that and given the very low percentage of the farm commodity value of the food dollar, it is a fairly marginal effect. Most economists that look at it figure that if you totally, you know, went New Zealand on ag policy and totally removed commodity support, there would probably be not much more than a 1 to 2% change in planted acres of any of the major commodities for the foreseeable future. So, and of course, in respect to corn and soybeans, not so much the other commodities, you also have the biofuels ethanol policy counteracting effect, which is raising prices. That one actually has more of an effect raising prices than farm bill commodity policies do lowering prices. So I just point that out. The other quickie to get out there, just because it's probably on some people's minds, is there is a popular habit in the farm press to say fruits and vegetables do not get any government support. And if by government support you mean direct checks, that is true. But if you mean, is there government intervention? Yes, there's massive government intervention, most of it being supply management intervention. Hence the planting flexibility prohibition is fought. It's the number one priority of the fruit and vegetable lobby because it is supply management for them. It is something that keeps their prices higher than they would be otherwise. Ditto for cosmetic standards and quality standards, ditto for marketing orders. All of those things are forms of supply management. And of course, there's a government purchase program that takes excess fruits and vegetables off the market. So all of those things are very real. They're very strong intervention. If you might even say they're bigger intervention than the commodity checks. So I just wanted to say those two things. So my idea, you know, this is probably obvious from things I've said already, but my idea is something has to be done about planting flexibility at some point. There's 320 million acres tied up of the best cropland in the country tied up in the commodity programs. If none of that can ever plant fruits and vegetables, we'll never make progress towards increasing the supply. But of course, supply can't increase if demand's not increasing, so these things work hand in hand. I think that the time is ripe to get the ball started. You can't say we're never going to do anything until you show us demand has increased by 50% or something. You have to get started somewhere. So I think there's plenty of opportunity to get started right now, make the first step, say that for local fresh marketing, there could be a small exemption to planting inflexibility so that regional markets could actually grow. I think that's something definitely worth talking about. Crop insurance, I'll move to crop insurance next. Crop insurance is actually now going to be bigger in terms of total federal dollars than commodities. Of course, it's many of the same commodities that get crop insurance, but fruits and vegetables also get crop insurance. The big issue for us in crop insurance, big sustainable and organic agriculture issue, is crop insurance policies now don't work for sustainable and organic producers. They work for commodity-specific producers to a degree. But for people who are into diversified production, there's no decent policies now that work, and that's just a huge issue for us. I think it could be a huge issue for the public health community. It's mind-numbingly boring when you get into the details of crop insurance. I'll warn you ahead of time, but a really, really important subject. I'll skip the credit title. There's probably less there, although the same concern applies to the credit title, how farmers can access credit. It's a big problem for farmers who are doing something out of the ordinary to access credit. So there are some issues there. Conservation is a huge issue for us. The one I would toss out there is perhaps the most important is making sure the Conservation Stewardship Program continues. It now has a $12 billion baseline for the next 10 years. That's nothing like the commodity baseline, but it is a really important start to having an alternative to commodity programs over the long term. If you think about it, there's $5 billion each year that goes for direct production incentives, and $12 billion over 10 years that goes for the alternative, which is paying farmers to produce environmental benefits. If we could not only keep CSP alive, but start to transition farmers from production incentives to environmental incentives over the long term, we could do a heck of a lot of good. I'll skip the energy title there now, but it is really important when we think about what the relative federal subsidy is for ethanol, a corn-based ethanol, or soy-based biodiesel, and the second generation alternatives. The energy title is very much all about that issue. So it is not unrelated to public health, but maybe not quite so directly. Rural development, let me just spend a moment on the rural development title. There's not much money in the rural development title. There should be, but there isn't. But it is where there are a number of programs that the Sustainable Agriculture Coalition has worked on that deal with local and regional food system infrastructure and marketing. There's value-added producer grants. There are local and regional food enterprise guaranteed loans. There's rural micro-enterprise business assistance and a variety of other programs that could continue to be tailored towards the building of local and regional food systems to build both economic development and a healthier food system. So I think that has lots of potential, and the current Secretary of Agriculture is particularly interested in this area, so I think it's ripe. The specialty crop title, especially if Senator Stabenow is the chair, is going to be very interesting to watch. It's a sort of the newbie on the block, got some real resources last time, the biggest one being the specialty crop block grant program, which is money that goes out to the states for anything the state wants to do that's related to fruits and vegetables. There is a real opportunity there to begin to drive that sort of basic block grant, no criteria program towards some criteria that would really be healthy food kind of criteria. Ronnie mentioned the research title, really big deal. I'll just throw out three things in the research title, all of which I think are doable. Antibiotic resistance research money for breeding, plant and animal breeding for organic and sustainable systems that's locally adapted and that really pays attention to food quality rather than mass production. And food safety training, which, by the way, Senator Stabenow is the champion of in the context of the food safety legislation, which is moving through Congress right now. So I would totally expect to see that back on the Farm Bill agenda. And then last but not least, the miscellaneous title, which comes at the very end of the Farm Bill, is where they put everything where they don't know where to put any, you know, if it's not obvious where else to put it. And that's where most of our beginning and minority farmer programs are. That's another one where the Secretary is really keen. He's set out a goal of increasing the supply of farmers in this country by 100,000 each year, which is a noble and high goal. And I think, you know, if people are really interested in healthy food, you need growers who are interested in producing it. And there is a very captive community amongst young farmers to do that, and we need to help them succeed. So that's my spaghetti throwing. I hope some of that maybe will stick to the wall.